Okay, this is the Lesbian Power Authority, and my name is Mev, and this evening I am interviewing in the studios Irvishi Vaid, who has written a new book called Virtual Equality. Welcome, Irvishi.
Thanks, Mev. It's nice to be here.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Irvishi Vaid? Who are you, and why did you write this book?
Okay. Big question. Who am I? You know, that's a pretty cosmic kind of question. I don't really know who I am, Mev. I'm a community organizer and activist and attorney. I've been working in the lesbian and gay movement and in the women's movement since the late 70s, and done a lot of different kinds of grassroots organizing, like many of us have done, and most recently, I worked for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force for 6.5 years in Washington, and then left at the end of 92, and I had been thinking about writing, taking a period of time to just take a break and from organizing and working and try to write something. And the project just grew into the book that you see now. I was lucky enough to get a publisher, but I spent 2.5 years researching, working and writing in Provincetown, where I live, Massachusetts. And the book is it's like a book that is on different levels, and it'll mean different things, I think, to different people who have varying levels of experience and involvement with politics and with the queer movement, especially. But I wanted to write a book that assessed the work that I'd seen and done myself in the gay and lesbian movement. So it's primarily about the mixed gay movement. And I wanted to particularly look at the strategies of civil rights mainstreaming and the civil rights paradigm that we've been using. And, coming into the movement as I did and do from the more left and grassroots side of the fence, and certainly the more from feminism, it's been a struggle for me personally and politically to push gay and lesbian organizations towards a more progressive vision. It's my argument in the book and my view that vision doesn't exist in the mainstream of the gay and lesbian movement, and that it needs to exist.
Could you explain what virtual equality means? How did you come up with that term? I mean, I assume it's refers to virtual reality on some level.
Right. Virtual reality is something that makes the artificial seem real, while virtual equality does the same with respect to equality, in my opinion. We live in a state of virtual equality as lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and transgendered people because the gains that we have won are very partial, provisional, conditional, illusory, and because there's so many paradoxes and contradictions that surround our equality. And among those are things like we have tremendous visibility, but we still don't have great understanding or comprehension of who we are by our families, friends, straight coworkers, or even sometimes I think by ourselves. We don't quite understand ourselves still. And if you look at any other aspect of gay life, politics, power, and public opinion, I think the status of gay people is more virtually equal than genuinely equal. Now, I also in my book argue that to me, genuine equality would be reached when we achieve a society in which, in a narrow sense, a society in which lesbian and gay people are viewed as morally equivalent to heterosexual people. And in a broad sense, I think we will reach genuine equality when we achieve a more just and fair society in economic terms, in racial terms, in gender terms, and in terms of sexual orientation issues. So that's my definition of the broad goal of genuine equality. And when you stack that up against what you see gay and lesbian organizations working for, I think you can see the differences pretty quickly. Because, our organizations and our movement as it's currently configured, are pretty much working for a narrow civil rights agenda. They're not working for social transformation necessarily. Some of us are. And that's always been the role of the progressive wing of the movement. I always think that the grassroots is more progressive than the organized movement, too.
And in the book, you focus a lot more on the national organizations. So when you're talking about the gay and lesbian movement in this book, you're largely talking about those on a national level, the NGLTF.
Talking about the book traces the emergence of a national movement over the last 45 years and outlines some of the strategies it's used, the conflicts that exist inside of it, the tensions and dynamics of it, and some of the weaknesses of focusing on a purely national strategy, which I think we have done. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think actually the national strategy should be for the next 5, 10, 15 years. What I'd love to see as an organizer is the national strategy of the gay and lesbian movement should be to build state organizations. That's a truly national strategy. Every issue we face is going to be fought out here at the local and state level. And I'm not so sure that even in a wonderful state like Minnesota, where people are incredibly mobilized and
in the Twin Cities.
Okay, not across the state. But, you know, if you faced somebody, these two women were at the reading last night at Amazon Books, and we were talking. I said, okay, what's coming up, you know, for you guys in the state, do you think? And they were like, oh, it's going to be awful. They think that you're going to face a repeal effort for the human rights law. They believe you're going to face a anti-marriage law, like a preemptive strike type bill, where they're going to prevent us from even, they'll say, you know, we won't never allow marriage in our state, but for gay people. And whatever you feel about these issues, the fact, I mean, if even if you're anti-marriage from a feminist perspective, you got to realize that any time a state legislature passes a law preventing gay people from exercising the same freedoms and civil equality that heterosexual people enjoy, we're in trouble. And we have to defend and fight against those kinds of issues. And they were anticipating a number of other really bad scenarios. And I said, so what's the level of mobilization around the state? And they were like, well, we've got this little fledgling organization, and it's working hard, but, you know, people aren't motivated. People don't see how urgent it is to do the simple things, the register to vote, to be connected to the group at the state level and be aware of what's happening on gay and lesbian issues.
One of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit about is the level of complacency. You mentioned a little bit in the book, and as a organizer who's been around the block several times, I feel, you know, I realize that coming from the late 60s and early 70s, I take for granted that as a feminist, as a lesbian, what my work needs to be about is doing anti-oppression work in all forms, that I'm always going to talk about class issues, I'm always going to talk about race issues, I'm always going to talk about sex and gender issues, and so on and so forth. And just basic things, like when you have an event, it has to be wheelchair accessible, it has to be physically accessible, it has to be financially accessible, all these things I realize that I take for granted. And I'm constantly amazed, and more amazed, as the years go on, how little of that has really carried forward, that a lot of lesbians who have been doing that work for a long time have either gone off, and I don't know where they've gone in some cases. They're burnt out, or they're tired, or they're watching television, or cruising the internet. I don't know what they're doing. And that there are other lesbians who are newly out of all ages, young and older women, who are not attuned to those issues as much, you know, who don't even think, you know, so, and it does feel like there's more and more complacency, not only among those of us who have been radicalized over time, but folks who are just coming out, or, you know, just the whole society in general, not only just about gay and lesbian issues, but, you know, about a lot of things.
Bringing up a lot of great points about what's going on, and I think that some of that is, you know, we have to be teaching always, and that insight that you learn from your work has to be taught to another generation of organizers and activists who don't necessarily have that written down. It's not, you know, it's not a lesson that you or I learned from studies. We learned from our organizing work and the knocks that we took as out dykes in the world. And I think that that experience gives us some perspective and some skepticism of the power structure, which generations that grow up when they didn't have to wage the same fights don't necessarily have. And they have to be reminded, and they have to be taught the history, and we have to listen to their new concerns and new arguments about what they're going through, because they have their own issues that are relevant for them, more relevant for them than ours were, you know, 10 years ago. So some of what I think is missing is a space for that kind of intergenerational, if you will, dialogue. I mean, I'm 37, and I'm, by my own reckoning, I'm pretty old in the movement, because I've been organizing since I was 17. You know, and that's a long time. And so the people who are organizing now at the age of 17 or 20 or 25, they have a whole new set of challenges and experiences. Some things I can contribute to them, and something they can contribute to me is to help me understand how to change my work now to be more relevant and effective to reach people like them. Mm-hmm. But the other second thing that's happened over the last period to 25 years has been a systematic attack on the ideas and values of progressive gay and lesbian liberation, of feminism, of the civil rights movement. I mean, part of why we live in a more conservative climate is that the right has been systematically attacking everything from the idea of critical thinking and you know, to the way the educational system is set up, to the teaching of multiculturalism and diversity in the educational system, to feminism. They've been attacking it ever since it emerged, the second wave, ever since the first wave emerged, it was attacked. And the anti-gay right wing has really grown since the late 70s to its present form. So we're also facing a very sophisticated and broad-based intellectual attack. And so we have to be engaged in that war of ideas, if you will. You know, we can't just say, we figured this out and you guys figure it out for yourself. And because we're losing it. When somebody like Dinesh D'Souza puts out books that are, you know, attacking the remedies that were developed to deal with racism, and saying that the remedies that were developed to deal with racism are now the cause of racism. You know, that's so what his book, The End of Racism, is all about. That in order to end racism, we have to basically have race-blind remedies. Mm-hmm. I mean, no race-conscious affirmative action, no nothing, and all. And this is an old conservative critique that actually goes back to Bakke.
Right.
And even
which
before.
Which bolsters racism as far as, right.
Yeah, and it ignores the fact that the affirmative action and strategies that the civil rights movement developed to support minority businesses and to, you know, pump some income and resources into people of color communities were strategies that were essential, mm-hmm. because that stuff wasn't happening. I mean, it wasn't just default that, poor school districts don't give as good schooling, or, you know, government contracts just didn't not happen to go to minority contractors. There was active racism there. Mm-hmm. And the strategies that were developed helped change the balance. And now the argument is made that, you know, those strategies are being scapegoated for a much deeper problem that exists, which is the problem of an economic system that is profoundly unjust and unfair and has to identify scapegoats in order to keep the current structure in place.
Mm-hmm. Which goes back to something that you said early on in the book, was when you're making a distinction between a civil rights movement and a liberation movement. And you were talking about culture and education in relation to legitimization and so on. Could you say a little bit more about that for those who haven't read the book yet?
I hope everybody will read the book, but the book, actually, I do really seriously hope a lot of people will pass it around and read it or buy it, whatever, because I'm throwing out a bunch of ideas based on my own experience as an organizer. This is not the definitive hardline polemic. I didn't write it in that way. I'm not particularly dogmatic about my ideas, but I am passionate about ideas. And I think we need, as progressive women, as progressive people, to debate the big picture. Where do we want the country to go? What values do we believe in? You know, affirm those values with each other, and then commit ourselves to action. Because we're in it. We got to be in it for the long haul. And part of what liberation means to me is a recognition that social change, if social change and social transformation and social justice for all people is our goal, that is a process that's going to take a long time. There's no quick answers or short-term fixes. You know, easy fixes. But I think that in the book, I trace the historical tension within lesbian and gay organizing of between legitimation strategies, which have argued that we just want a place at the table, that we want to assimilate into the current status quo, and liberation strategies, or liberation-oriented perspective, which has argued that we are different from the status quo, and that difference can help to change that status quo in good ways, and that we don't want a place at the table. We want to, you know, get rid of the table and build a new one that's more inclusive. So in a pretty crude way, I think those are the dynamics that we've operated within. And for a long time, I saw it as an either-or. Either you were for legitimation or you were for liberation. Now, this may be one of the areas in which we part company, because I've come to see it much more dialectically, both and. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know, there's a continuum of work that needs to be done, and some of it is absolutely legitimation-oriented. I mean, the gay and lesbian movement, that we can sit here, you and I, at this moment and broadcast a lesbian show is a byproduct of the gay and lesbian civil rights movement that said we should have equal access to the airwaves for our ideas, that said, you know, that helped create a gay and lesbian community and an identity and gave us the strength to be here as individuals. I guess I value that very much, and I'm very committed to gay and lesbian civil rights. We should have every equal right to participate and be proud and open in this society as any other person has. And we should fight for the rights of all people to that kind of equality. What we want is equality. And that's a meaningful word to me,
right.
from the experience of not having equality. But the other side of it is that, as I said, I also recognize that fitting into a morally bankrupt system isn't satisfying. and so, I move along in the continuum and the dialectic between liberation and legitimation towards liberation. And I'm looking for, I think we need to freshen up our language. Because even when I say these words, I hear myself and I say, oh, Irvishi, you're being so vague. You're using words that don't resonate in the 90s, you know, and they put people off and so on and so forth. So, you know, I'm conscious of the way that the language itself may need freshening up, but I'm also clear that what we're talking about is meaningful, and what we're talking about is a real different direction than the one that the mainstream gay movement is taking, the one that mainstream civil rights movements are taking, the one that the mainstream women's movement is taking,
right,
for that matter.
Mm-hmm. And I would agree with you that it is a both-and situation. And I personally gear myself more toward the liberation progressive end of it, and find that a lot of what is happening in the civil rights gay and lesbian movement does, to some extent, exactly contradict what is progressive. I mean, what you mentioned before, gay marriage is sort of like, well, you know, so many folks want to have marriage. Well, let's look at this institution of marriage a little bit and, you know, peel the layers apart about that. And where did that come from? And, you know, some of it really is based in male ownership of women. So why is that important in a lesbian community, for example, then? Why, you know, and I do think that we have to honor our relationships and call each other as a community to say, so-and-so are together and this is how they've committed themselves. I think it's limiting to look at it only as a couple situation. And this is a conversation that's been going on in the lesbian community for years, you know, about
monogamy,
group houses, this and that. We've tried different things. Some things have worked, some things haven't. I think there is more, it feels to me like there's this more emphasis going into gay marriage. And I worry that that is an assimilation thing. And where are the challenges to that now? And the voices that are have challenged that seem a lot quieter to me recently. And that disturbs me because I do think that there is some way in which a movement that becomes more assimilative than liberationary. And what you said about finding the language, and I think I find that very conflictual, you know, that, you know, oh, it's just empty rhetoric. Well, it's visionary, I think, you know, it's... maybe it sounds like rhetoric to some folks, and maybe it has become rhetoric for some folks, but I think there's a lot more visionary to it than that.
Yeah, it's also, community, our community has changed, and that's inevitable. There's more people in it. There's more different types of people in it. There are people who genuinely aren't feminists or lesbian feminists who don't understand or want to understand that perspective.
Or have fought the backlash against feminism, so don't want to be identified with feminists because it's got such a bad rap right now.
So, you know, when you're a political leader or activist or organizer in the community as it is today, I think it's tough because you have to pay attention to so many kinds of concerns, you know? And there isn't that, the kind of cohesion and the cohesiveness that I felt too in the lesbian community of the 70s isn't necessarily there in the lesbian community of the 90s. And even in the 70s we were being, you know, we were that cohesiveness was very we were critical of ourselves because we recognized that there were racial differences and that race, you know, really racism was a deep part of what we what led to sort of there was a white gay and white lesbian community and a white lesbian culture, and then sort of a more mixed white and women of color kind of stuff. And then the lesbians of color were emerging and developing identity-based movements and developing identities.
And class issues and issues of ableism and all of those things.
And we were conscious of all those differences. And I think that that consciousness is particularly lesbian feminist, and I love that consciousness. And you're absolutely right that I don't know a single lesbian feminist who would ever produce an event that wouldn't be wheelchair accessible, or you know, and unfortunately, that consciousness doesn't necessarily exist in the gay and lesbian movement, which is interesting.
Yeah, which I think two things. So what you said earlier about putting forth your own, you know, that this is not the thesis on, you know, gay and lesbian activism, but people are making it that way. I mean, I haven't read that much of what's out there in the press, but The Advocate recently had you on the cover. And in the article, you know, it was just sort of like, well, you know, this is going to be a big controversial book, and, you know, she's really rattling some cages and this and that and the other thing. And then on the same page, I thought it was so interesting when you're saying, you know, you have some very interesting things to say about leadership and how we are all leaders and so on and so forth. And yet there's The Advocate putting up there that, you know, who do you think should be the lesbian, the leader?
I know, they did not read my chapter on leadership.
Obviously.
They didn't even read it.
I mean, this is like very hetero, you know, very hierarchical thinking.
It's very mass media, you know, bogus.
Well, don't you think it's male to some extent?
I think it's more popular culture. I think it's more like... I don't know that it's male because I think there would be lesbian magazines who are lifestyle magazines who would do the same thing.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, I can see that poll in Deneuve or or others.
Right.
And, you know, and I read those magazines, Girlfriends. They're fun. But they're lifestyle magazines. They're not necessarily political. They're not coming from a political, deep political perspective. They're coming from a general political sense that lesbians are great and wonderful, and I like that. I like anybody who's putting out the message that, you know, we're out, we're beautiful, and we're fabulous, and we're different, and we're dykes. I support them. But I don't know that it's so much male, but you bring up a good point about, no, see, but I come at this whole issue, the reason I don't necessarily I've been working in the mixed gay and lesbian movement for a long time. And I've also done, alongside of that, I've also worked in women's groups or lesbian groups, whether they're direct action or, you know, like cultural lesbian feminists like Roadwork, which produced the Sister Fire Festival, that kind of stuff. But I know a lot of women don't engage in mixed gay movement work, a lot of lesbians. I don't really want to deal with some of the sexism that you do find there. And I guess that's okay with me. I mean, I'm comfortable that there's enough work to do that we can each choose our particular forum and still do really important work towards the broader goal of a more just society. I guess I hope that women, you know, will still read the book, because I do think that the gay and lesbian movement today is different than it was 15 years ago because of the involvement of lesbians over the last 15 years.
How so?
Oh, there's a lot of the feminist issues that we were working on, the feminist health agenda, for example, became the gay and lesbian health agenda because lesbians brought it in and because AIDS forced us to deal with a health issue that was affecting men. So the men had to look at the way, have to have a strategy about the healthcare system. And the, you know, I mean, think about it. 20 years ago, gay organizations weren't talking about Medicare, welfare, Social Security, insurance issues. They weren't talking about community-based health centers necessarily, although there was a fledgling gay community health movement. I just think I can see, and I talk a little bit in my book only about how the kind of feminist self-help health model that was being developed, that had been developed in the lesbian feminist movement of the 70s, really was the boilerplate out of which AIDS organizations were created. You know, and a lot of the values and the kind of empowerment of clients and individuals is very much comes out of a feminist tradition of, you know, doing away with the old doctor-patient relationship and empowering people to make their decisions, you know? Mm. That model was very feminist. Mm. And the focus on economic aspects of healthcare system and healthcare delivery and healthcare access was also a very important concern for feminism. I guess I see the other changes that I see in the lesbian and gay movement as a result of the involvement of women. I mean, just simply, there are more women in leadership positions. Most of the boards of the organizations that I know are mixed 50-50 or, committed to it or trying to be. It's not the same. It used to be that, you know, if you got three women on a board of 15 people, it was considered mixed. Well, that's changed. The March on Washington in 93, you know, the steering committee was men and women, and one of the coordinators was the fabulous woman of color, Nadine, you know, Smith, who did a great job as a media spokeswoman for the entire movement. I really thought she was excellent. And so on, and, you know, you can look at down the line, Melinda Paras, who runs the NGLTF, Elizabeth Birch, who now runs the HRCF. Mm-hmm. We've always had strong women dyke leaders in Minneapolis. That's a hallmark of this place. And St. Paul. You might listen to me and say, yeah, well, we've always had that, Irv. But, you know, the rest of the country hasn't.
Right. Well, could you talk a little bit about the leadership stuff? Because I think that ties in with complacency too, your view of leadership and how you describe it in the book. Because I found that pretty interesting. And calling forth for people.
Yeah, I very much believe that the focus on heroic, extraordinary, magnificent leaders is misguided. Those people are truly exceptional. They may appear in our midst and in our lives, you know, but we can't wait around and go and pretend that, that we don't have leaders while we wait around. Right. In fact, the whole question of where is our Martin Luther King or where is our Gloria Steinem or whatever is a question that is rude and disrespectful to the many grassroots leaders we do have. We have. I argue in my chapter that we are a community rich in leaders, because in order to become a gay activist, you have to stand up in some way to the oppression that you experience in your life. And I see leadership coming from people all in every field of work, in every part of this country, who have built, you know, the leaders who built community centers and hotlines and youth groups. There's leaders who stood up against discrimination in the workplace and in the army even, and, you know, all those folks. I consider that a form of leadership. And in my chapter, I think that we need to develop, cultivate, nurture, you know.
It seems we do the exact opposite. I mean, we're really good at undoing anyone who has, which is an issue of power that you mentioned, the position of real power versus perceived power.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we do to our leaders a lot. Huh. We perceive that they have a certain amount of power, yeah, and confuse that with any real power that someone might have, and then spend a lot of time undoing anybody who takes any initiative to get going on anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's really important, I think, to support leadership. Now, that doesn't mean you have to agree with everything they say or shut up about it if you disagree. It does mean that you express your disagreements in a way that doesn't tear down the kind of integrity of the other person. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I've been called every name in the book and had my fundamental, you know, dyke integrity challenged, which deeply offends me every time that happens. I mean, like, who are you, you know, to say these horrible things about, to make these horrible judgment about my motives or my agenda or my being, you know? And I always believe that we're measured by our deeds, and I'm proud of my deeds. So, I mean, excuse me. Anyway, but the point I'm trying to make is that but I've also gotten great criticism, like really painful and helpful criticism, you know, like people who disagreed with a decision that I might have made running an organization, or people who challenged me on a position I took or failed to take. I mean, really helpful critical feedback, and that's what I call accountability and holding our leaders accountable for their leadership. And leaders themselves have to realize that you have a responsibility to dialogue and not be aloof and, you know, cut off. Mm-hmm. And I think there's several problems going on in the movement right now that, I mean, it isn't just that we have negative self-image so that we don't want any one of us to succeed, or we want the perfect leader and so we're angry whenever there's imperfection. Maybe there's those psychological dimensions are definitely operating. And the whole phenomena of horizontal hostility, as it's been called. But there's also some structural problems around leadership. We have no leadership training programs or leadership development mechanisms that are formalized. And I think that would be very helpful, particularly to, like, young leaders I meet who are in the community or in college and university campuses. They're very frustrated about how they can connect with the movement, because there's not very many ways for them to do that. I think there's a problem that we have structurally around the media, and our media I'm talking about, not the straight press, the lesbian and gay alternative media. And that problem is that the media stirs it up instead of enlightening. You know, they
it's
love to
media.
you know, and that's irresponsible journalism. And I'm not saying don't talk about the bad stuff or don't talk about the controversies. I'm saying, to what end are you doing it? You know, when you have publishers of newspapers trashing somebody because they don't personally like them because 5 years ago they crossed their path in some way and they had a fight. I mean, personal vendettas being played out in a public discourse happens constantly. And it happens in every movement. Mm. My suggestion is in my book that we actually have the courage to call it out and say it. Because a lot of times what I see happening is there's a personal conflict, it gets elevated into a political difference, And we only talk about the political difference, and we only gossip about the personal conflict. Mm-hmm. Well, she did this with that one because they were exes and blah, blah, yeah. blah, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe we should just bring it out.
And I think we should also stop using the word trashing. I find that as soon as somebody says, oh, well, I got trashed because I said, or, oh, you know, the situation got resolved because somebody got trashed or whatever. And I find that that's a great silencer. And I think it's a word we should just, I mean, it might have been useful at one time. I don't know. I find that it really stops discourse a lot of times. Because as soon as you say, oh, you're trashing me, or, you know, so-and-so trashed somebody else, or whatever, then it's the end of the conversation.
You know? Yeah.
And that's not to say we shouldn't take care of how we say things or,
yeah.
you know, be, you know.
But again, you know, I guess I'm focusing on the structures that we have in our community and their responsibility, institutions. And I am perturbed by the gay and lesbian media's, you know, way of treating gay and lesbian leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the Advocate example, I mean, is a perfect example in some ways of that. That's a celebrity model, you know. You kind of elevate individuals to this, like, star thing level, which is something I've always had a problem with as an activist. I'm not, you know, a performer. I'm not a celebrity. and yet the media machine has made me one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting problem. But one of the consequences of that is that they ignore a lot of other people when they choose to spotlight a few people. And so I think the regional press and the local media has to compensate for that. But they don't. The local press and the regional media often repeat what the national media is doing. So, you know, if RuPaul is on the cover of Out, RuPaul will be on the cover of 15 grassroots magazines. And that's not to take a thing away from RuPaul. I love RuPaul, you know, and maybe he should be on the cover of all those papers. But but what I don't ever see is the head of the local community center being on the cover with a big profile about their life and their work and their experience and what made them, you know, take activism in their community. Mm-hmm. I don't often see profiles of, like, people who have been in your town doing the work day in, day out for 25 years or even five years or 2 years, because mm-hmm. each of us has a great story. And the building up of leadership and the creation of that kind of respect for the leaders we have comes only through us getting to know them a little bit. Because how are you going to, you know, you hear the name, you don't necessarily think there's a whole deep, rich person behind that name. You just hear the, you know, we're so inundated with information. It's like you hear a blip about some gay local leader and, you know, and it's in a second you make a judgment. Oh, they're good or they're bad. Or I like them or they don't. They might be wearing a outfit you don't like, and you say, oh, I don't like them. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's the role of the gay and lesbian press to go beyond that superficiality, to help us see who these people are. And then we can make a better judgment about, well, you know, I really respect this person.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really believe in grassroots leadership. I think that the other structural thing that we have to change over the next few years is our reliance on the national movement organizations as our sole place to look for leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully as statewide lesbian and gay organizations get stronger and you have activists in every county that are connected into the statewide organization, we will start to see really strong leadership emerge all over.
Mm-hmm. I think what that some of what you said also brings up another thing that you talk about in the book, which I don't hear people talking about very much at all, is morality. Mm-hmm. I mean, you say these are some moral issues that I think are important for our movement as gay and lesbian people. I think so because morality is an argument that is used against us, that, you know, we try not to make ethical or moral decisions, you know, you should do this, or because we've got, it's worked against us so much. And yet you're willing to say, these are some pieces of behavior that I think we should work with each other about. And I'd like to hear you say a little bit about that.
Uh-huh. I believe very strongly that lesbians and gay men are ethical, moral human beings, that we have a sense of fairness and right and wrong, and that we have values. And I also think that some of our value system, by virtue of being stigmatized by morality, is very different from the moralism and the kind of, you know, hierarchical, religious-based value systems that we grew up with. Some of us actually keep those morals and those religious-based value systems and find a way to harmonize who we are as queers with, you know, our faith-based frameworks of morality. But what I suggest in my last chapter is that we might want to have more debate about what are the other kinds of, what are the uniquely queer, if any, moral frameworks that come out of our experience. And I put out a couple of ideas about what coming out represents and how I believe we should each feel and teach that we have a moral imperative to come out, that there's a moral responsibility to be out individually, that responsibility is owed to you, yourself, first. So that's one thing I throw out. There's other things about our commitment to joy, which I love, and what that means, because is that a moral, does that have moral implications? I mean, I'm just throwing these things out to see if people can start to think about it. I think some women have been thinking about it. I mentioned that lesbian, I think lesbian theorists like Sarah Lucia Hoagland and even Julia Penelope and others, Claudia Card, have been writing about this kind of stuff from a lesbian ethical perspective for a while. I think that African-American intellectuals like Cornel West and bell hooks have been writing about this from that perspective. So there's a lot of good work out there that is a launching pad for the kinds of stuff, but it's not necessarily a conversation that is being had inside gay activist circles. And if it's being brought up, it's being brought up by conservatives, mm-hmm. who are, you know, I'm sorry, Bill Bennett's Book of Virtues isn't what I mean by a moral framework. You know,
yeah.
That smug, smarmy guy who is now, you know, become apparently national censor. You know, the most recent uh-huh. issue is the talk shows. Before it was rap music. And, you know, I have a real problem with his smug moralism. Mm-hmm. And which is all extremely calculated and opportunistic and all about profit for him, completely.
Right.
And I have a real problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's being uncritically accepted. So that's not at all what I hope that I'm coming across as in my book. It's more of my concerns about these things come from a couple of sources. That one is that the way that we treat each other, and again, in lesbian feminism, we've talked at length about this. You know, what you mentioned earlier, the trashing type stuff, and I see what you're saying about the use of that word, and yet I also think that that did happen. You know, putting each other down, and was that an honorable thing to do? Was that an ethical thing to do? How we related, you know, Audrey and Rich addressed it in the notes on honor and lying, that essay that she wrote. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm thinking of. And I don't know, I'm sorry, are we running out of time?
No, we're not at all. Just going to check the tape here and see where we are.
Cool.
This is a lesbian radio show. And we talked a little bit before we actually started taping this interview. Some of the concerns that I had about the book, I mean, there are some. There's a lot that I agree with. There's a lot that I don't agree with. And that's true for anybody when they read a book, and you know, those are worth talking about. I think the thing that concerns me about it is that a lot of what happens to lesbians and feminist lesbians and separatist lesbians is that there's lots of ways in which we, our history and our work becomes invisibilized and taken for granted or not given credit or any of those. Their history gets rewritten around us and those kinds of things. And I think that there are certainly places in the book where you hold up certain examples of good lesbian work, like the cultural work of Olivia and the festivals and some of those things. And then there are other places where I feel like you're unduly harsh in some other places, and it's so brief what you say about them. I'm like, wait a minute, come back here and talk about this some more. You didn't talk about this enough for me, you know.
First time I've heard anybody say a 400-page book is brief.
Well, I didn't say, actually, there was a lot of places in the book that I did skip because I found that as a lesbian that there was a lot of stuff in there about men that just was not interesting to me, you know, and I, you know,